Welcome to another episode of Fans in Motion, the ultimate Night Ranger and rock and roll podcast. How you guys doing out there? Glad to see you back for part two of the Kelly Kagi Dawn Patrol era interview. Got a lot of great feedback from part one. I'm glad you guys are back to listen to part two. A couple years ago, if you guys don't, you know, some of you don't remember, we did a interview with Kelly that went back from his youth all the way up to the Dawn Patrol release. If you want to find that, obviously go to YouTube, or if you go to fansinmotion.com, go back. It's episodes 43, 44, and 45. That'll get you those years. Obviously, the last episode was part one. Here is part two. So thanks for joining and joining us for part two. Subscribe to the Facebook page, to the YouTube page, all the pages, man. Go to them all. Click subscribe and join and all that good stuff. But here you are, Kelly Kagi, part two. Enjoy. Another song I want to kind of talk about is Penny, a song that's still occasionally thrown into the set list, even today. So Penny, written by Jack Blades, but it's a track that you sing. Now, my own personal theory is, now most of you guys know that, and Jack tells a story that Jack used the name Penny. Penny is a friend of his wife's. And he used that name, and he jokes around about his wife giving him shit for, why are you writing a song about Penny? And I kind of picture it in my head that Jack realizes, I wrote it, and if I sing it, my wife's never going to let me get out of the doghouse. So he's probably like elbowing you and saying, hey,
I'm gonna take this one.
Kelly, I got a song
off of me, buddy.
But explain that, you know, process to me. And again, it's probably real easy. Feel is probably the answer. But there are songs that really stick out of my head that are so, when I think of them, I think of your voice. Penny, Why Does Love Have to Change? Obviously, Sentimental Street Goodbye, which are Jack, you know, written stuff. But you have the vocal. Just explain that process of that decision making to where it comes up to like, hey, let's have you sing this one.
It's a gray area, definitely gray area. It a lot of times it had to do, like I said earlier, about the producer making decisions. He would want to hear the difference, since he knew he had two lead vocalists in the band. He wanted to hear the difference. And, you know, like Jack sang Sentimental Street in the studio. And then I was asked to try it. You know, that we did that a lot in the studio. When we were there to do vocals, it was an open, you know, it was totally open. Like, okay, why don't you try, you know, that's how we got the split songs too. Sometimes, you know, we realized that that was a good way to go, because it didn't just keep the focal point on one voice. It changed up the texture of the song a little bit. And that's what we were looking to do, is kind of keep that, the interest in, you know, the listening audience. And it happened a lot in the studio. You know, the producer would go, Pat, you know, of course, would say, why don't you go out there and try that? Or why don't you go out and sing that second verse? You know, and then join Jack on the chorus, you know, like we did with When You Close Your Eyes. You know, I sang the pre-chorus part. I mean, and with, you know, like Young Girl in Love, you know, if we were sitting together and we came up with melodies or whatever, stuff like that, you know, right then we would know if somebody was going to be really good for that song, you know, Penny, you know. But that's a funny story about Molly going, why did you write a song about Penny? You know, she's my closest friend, you know. You never wrote a song about me. I'm sure she never said that.
Yeah.
He was furious, and then Jack said, you better take a heat off of me, buddy.
I wrote a song that I know is perfect for you. Because I always joked around too. I was like, I know some of the women I've dated to where if I wrote a song, like when you close your eyes, I just need something to fill in that, that time measure. But at home, I'd be like, it'd be like, who the fuck's Angie?
Yeah.
Baby, it's just a song. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Exactly.
So was there ever any songs out there that you rehearsed on, but the producer was like, I want Jack on this one, where you were like, shit, I would have loved to had that leaked vocal. Like, I always could picture you singing maybe like Rumors in the Air, right?
Right.
So I don't know, was there ever an instance where you can think
No,
of the
I was just open to anything. I think that's what made our band work early on too. And it probably goes well goes to say with Brad and Jeff too, because there's two guys that could play any of those parts. So when you're open to being creative, you would just allow stuff like, I'll try that, I'll do that. You don't get like, attached to it. I mean, I've written songs that I thought were hit songs, and just didn't work out, and I was, like when you're writing a song, you get so into it. That you want to make it your own. You want to put your stamp on there. But in that situation, when you're in the studio doing an album, you just have to be open to any changes. Write it right at the last minute. Boom, you're gonna go in there. You're gonna go sing that. I mean, like when I was asked to sing, Sentimental Street, I didn't think it was right for me because Jack had been putting his inflections on there. He wrote the lyrics. He kind of lived that part, and it was kind of, I'm sure he was probably disappointed. We even talked about that though, because we were just there. It's like, okay, you try it. Okay, you go in and try it. So when it came down to that, I don't think, well, Jack and I never really talked about it. It was a decision that was made by Pat.
Well, I'm sure if he was disappointed by it when he got his first royalty check, it helped him get over it. Probably,
I mean, I'm a big fan of his, so anything he does, I love, and he knows me really well, and he's a big fan of mine too. So that's where we get along so well vocally, because we can both kind of like, we get each other, and we're like, yeah, man, you could sing, and he's probably even more so than me. He can really like, tell. That's going to be you. That you can sing that. You can sing the heck.
What about, and the last song I want to touch on, and of course, I have to mention this song off Dawn Patrol, Don't Tell Me You Love Me. Do you remember the first time, is there one of these great stories where, you're in the studio and Jack comes in, hey guys, I want you to hear this. Do you remember the first time you ever heard that, or was that just another song in a pile of others, and eventually it becomes what it is today? Or did you know right off that, hey, this is something unique?
Well, I mean, like I had mentioned earlier that some of the demos that we did for that album that got us signed didn't have Don't Tell Me You Love, didn't have some of those hit songs. And those were written, when we knew we were going to do an album. Okay, now we got to finish off, we got to write more songs. So a lot of that stuff came in, like Jack would bring an idea during rehearsals, pre-rehearsal. Before we went in the studio. So it might come in as a chorus idea, and then we put it together. Okay, how we're going to start this, So I mean, all that stuff starts to fly around, when you grab those ideas out of the sky. Yeah, that works, you know. So, you know, like I said, those, the songs that were on the first demo was like Penny, you know, I want to say Eddie, definitely Play Rough and Thrill.
Mm-hmm.
It was either Penny or Sing Me Away.
Yeah.
Right there, but those other three songs were the right, right ones on the demo. And so, you know, there was no Don't Tell Me You Love Me. There was, you know, we had played around with Sister Christian, you know.
Yep.
So we were playing that before we ever got signed, you know, in clubs. But it was a totally kind of different kind of vibe to it. And so was Touch of Madness or Diary of a Madman. That those lyrics came into becoming, you know, it became Touch of Madness. And there was a lick that went with that Diary of a Madman. There's a live recording of us doing it.
Oakland of 81, I think.
Yeah, exactly. When we were opening for like Judas Priest or something.
Yep.
Interesting. So you see how things happen. You know, long after, you know, that, you know, we did an album and Jack and I decided to use the Hang On, you know, which was a demo song that we put on our first demos to try to get signed and never got used as a song. You know?
It's just, I always love the history, like just hearing your history of these songs. Like we talked to Johnny Cola from Huey Lewis in the News, who was in the last incarnation of Rubicon along with you. And in that weird little period where you, Jack, and Brad were going from Rubicon to Stereo to Ranger, you know, Johnny Cola said that you guys brought him in to sing on a couple demos.
Yeah.
And one of them, he couldn't remember the other track, but he was positive that the one was Penny. And, you know, it was just cool just thinking, you know, that Penny was one of those original tracks before some of the others, and that there's a version of Johnny Cola singing it. And
probably singing the background.
Well, he said that he sang the lead vocals on it, but he said even though it was a demo, he thought you guys, it was more, he thought it was more of a audition, maybe just to see how well he could sing and maybe go to like backup vocals. Again, I think this is more Stereo when maybe you guys were going to have horns. I don't know. And he said that, you know, obviously that never materialized, but he said that he sang lead vocals on two songs for you guys for that demo. And he said, also, he said he pretty much has everything that he's ever recorded. Like he has that whole archive, and he said he does not have those two songs. So if you ever come across it, but he did know, he did remember Penny. He said he probably remembers Penny just because it made it onto the record. He goes, maybe the second song, he couldn't remember. And maybe it was something that never made it onto a record.
Well, we have the master tapes of those demos. There were 8-track. And I think it was Gary Peel brought those tapes to us because he had the tape machine and we recorded in his studio. So he brought them over and we have them. I think Jack has them in his tape vault. So we were going to crack them open and listen.
Well, you know, you have a lot of fans right now. Just
the, like, miserable version of Sister Christian.
Well, listen.
So slow. It was like gut-wrenching. And it was a cassette of those that that point of time, you know, when we did those demos. I don't remember Cola singing on them, though.
Well, this would probably have been before that. He was thinking it was 79 still, and he just said it was like he, you know, brought him in for two songs. And he goes, it was like a demo, but he goes, I'm pretty sure it was more like an audition. Them checking him out. And, you know, he kind of went there to check you guys out. And he goes, ultimately, they made the right decision and he made his decision and it worked out for both of you. But so with this record coming out in November of 82, do you remember being able to, do you have any recollection of being able to walk into a record store for the first time and seeing this record with, you can yeah. flip it over? Do you remember that, you know, anything? Well,
the one thing I remember is we went to Japan first and overwhelmed on the promotion and the attention we were getting in Japan. So when we came back, we felt like we came back to obscurity because they hadn't really started to punch away at radio and get those songs played. So we came, we did the tour of Japan and came back and we were like, you know, we were hearing the songs on radio, but I don't think it was really that apparent that it was in the radio, in the record stores yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was, but I remember just the flurry of activity coming back from Japan, getting ready to go out with Kiss and promote on the East Coast and in the South.
So with that mention of Kiss, so, you know, the record comes out, you guys are back in the States right at the end of 82. You do a few dates, I think, with maybe Heart up in Washington or something like that.
Those were the first dates that we did was 2 dates with Heart.
Yeah. But then the first tour you guys attach yourself to is the Creatures of the Night tour with Kiss. Kiss is still in makeup. They haven't really toured the United States in 3 years at that point. Now, this isn't the Kiss of, you know, 76, 77, and 78. Kiss is at one of their lowest points, but they're still in the makeup. They've got two new members, Eric Carr, Vinnie Vincent. But it's still Kiss. They're still playing arenas, maybe not fully packed. But you guys are suddenly thrust into going to shows or playing concerts in arenas for this iconic band in makeup, which, again, I think it's the uniqueness of it is it isn't like you're going out again opening for Heart, which is a great classic rock band. You are opening for the makeup and the tank and the explosions.
Real hard rock, you know, the real thing. I know. And we were kind of nervous about that. I mean, especially in the beginning, you know, because Kiss fans are pretty, you know, they're pretty tough on you, you know, especially if they don't know you. And, you know, we weren't metal looking at all back then. You know, we had a lot of color and, you know, like, you know, so yeah, there were some times when stuff was flying up on stage and it was like somebody's going to get hurt, you know, big chunk of metal, you know, on the stage and shit like that. So, but we learned then, you know, about performance, you know, you can't just stand up there and play, you have to perform. And I think that was what got us moving quickly, is that we, it was like, okay, guys, you got to be a moving target. You can't, don't worry about it. Just get out there and rock and roll. You know, don't stand in one place. They're going to be throwing shit at you. You know, so in the beginning, that's kind of what it was. And then we started to be comfortable, you know, with it. So, yeah, I mean, those first dates with Kiss were great. I mean, you know, we played with Heart, and that was right at the end of the year. You know, we played in Portland and in Seattle, so like right in their hometown. So that was fun. But then once we got with Kiss later on, and that was when it really started to, like,
that's a good rock and roll 101 to kick off, you know, your touring career. So you're on this tour, your album's just breaking, you're out there with Kiss, and then almost right from Kiss you guys go to Sammy Hagar,
right?
Probably a better fit. And history, I mean, obviously you guys are kind of the same area. You guys knew David Lauser, Gary Peel, The guitarist had helped produce some of your first demos. Fitz was in Sammy's band, you know, in the 78.
There was a great camaraderie when we went on that tour. Every day, it was great to see each other, talk, you know, just shoot the shit or whatever, and just we got along really great. You know.
So is there ever a moment, a couple questions like this, the one I want to ask here, is there you ever just, you know, a year before, even 6 months before, kind of like what you said, you're kind of unknown. You got a record coming out, and all of a sudden, you know, it's spring, you're playing dates with Sammy Hagar in arenas. You're getting recognized. Do you ever get like, and again, you'd been at this for 8 years, you know, with Rags and, you know, studio work and all this other stuff, you know, Rubicon. And do you ever feel like the sense of accomplishment? Do you ever get to like smell the roses, or is it just constantly everything just happening so quick?
Yeah, a lot of movement, a lot of action going on. But where you get it is when you're standing there and you're playing those songs and you're getting that reaction from the crowd. That's where you really feel it. And then as that tour went on and we were, you know, we'd have some days off or whatever, we started to see people recognize us when we were out carrying our laundry to the laundromat from the hotel or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody go, hey, you know, and because the video was really getting a lot of play, and of course we were in town where the concert was going to be, and people just were looking for you, you know. So that really, it really started to become apparent that it was like, wow, things are really different now. Things are really changing, you know. I'm not just this guy that likes goes and plays cover tunes and, you know, with the Alameda All Stars and, you know, on weekend, you know, it's like our music, you know, it's our band, it's our material, our voices are, and we were just beside ourselves. A lot of times we'd be like, wow, this thing is really, really taking off. You know?
Well, and you guys were one of the first new bands that dealt with this new entity called MTV. Where it used to be, you could be a new band, and the only way audiences would know you is from the back of your album cover. And occasionally, if you were on the Midnight Special or Don Kirshner's Rock, you know, Rock and Roll or whatever. But, you know, MTV comes out August of 81. Now, not every city, state has that. But by the time early 83, your guys' record coming out, it's popular, it's expanding. Oh. You guys have two videos that are put on. So you guys are in this unique time frame of MTV basically being born and coming out, and Night Rangers right along with it. Just, you know, tell us a little bit of how, you know, your thoughts of MTV and how that just changed the musical landscape, and maybe, you know, obviously changed your guys's career arc.
Well, I mean, you know, back in the Beatles days, you know, they used to do videos, you know, they used to do promotional videos of the band lip syncing to their songs. And, you know, so it went out of popularity for a while, but then when they came up with a TV channel that people could just watch videos. I mean, and the how large the audience got at that point for us, that just propels your music into a whole new height, you know. And that's what we were experiencing, you know. It wasn't just radio anymore. It was a visual thing, you know. So once you experience that, it just accelerates everything, you know. Radio started playing it, and, you know, and just started playing more songs than just one, you know, single or the two singles. You know, they were playing other songs. It started hearing Eddie, you know, on the radio, which is great. I mean, really great to hear that song on there. Penny too. So, you know, I mean, knowing that you're making a difference when you're out there touring, because there is so much activity, you find it hard to stop and just like look around and go, you know, what's going on? What are we doing? You know, where are we going next? You know, and where, you know, you could be in like New York or someplace like that, you know, far away from home. You know, so you're just going along with this train, you know, you're just trying to hang on and keep it, you know, keep it on the tracks, you know, and at the same time, enjoy it, you know, and look around and go, wow, this is amazing, you know. So, yeah, we felt very lucky and, you know, fortunate that we were on that train.
And I mean, you have those two iconic videos. I mean, obviously, Don't Tell Me You Love Me, you know, was all over MTV. People still talk about it. It's the video with the train and everything. And you had, you know, Sing Me Away on there. But you guys also did some other promotional shows at the time, which is great because we have that archival footage. You have, you know, you guys were on Solid Gold with Rex Smith hosting.
American Bandstand.
I couldn't remember if American Bandstand was during Dawn Patrol or if it was right at the beginning of Midnight
Dawn
Madness.
Patrol. We did the two songs on there. We did Sing Me Away and Don't Tell Me You Love Me on Bandstand.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I was going to save that for Midnight Madness, but I was talking to Brad, and Brad has some great unreleased photos of you guys with Dick Clark. And it really kind of seemed Dick Clark, maybe, you know, Dick Clark was just a great guy and he enjoyed everybody. But, you know, there's some great photos of him, you know, goofing around with you guys. I think he has a Night Ranger sweater on. You guys are holding him up in the air. That's got to be a thrill to where, again, you grow up, you know, at that point, Dick Clark had still probably been on for 20 some years.
What an icon.
And do you ever have one of those moments of, you know, holy shit, there's Dick Clark.
I know. I mean, it was like, you know, again, you know, you're in a whirlwind of activity, you know, you're being, you know, escorted in there and, you know, we're getting ready to play and then we're going to perform live on, you know, not live, but, you know, lip sync on TV, and we're nervous as shit about that. You know, because we didn't really know the songs well enough. I mean, we're used to playing live, so we were used to embellishing the songs.
Yes.
Live. Now we have to copy, you know, a recording, and maybe we don't know it perfectly, you know. So it was a kind of a nerve-wracking situation to have to lip sync. So I remember on Dick Clark, the union didn't want you to touch anything on the stage except for your own instrument. Like if there was a microphone stand there and you grabbed it, they'd go, you know, hold on, you know, we'll move it for you, you know, let us do it, you know. So that was it, the union. And I remember we thought that was kind of like, man, that's weird. Why are they like uptight about that? You know, they just were. And so I remember when I did Sing Me Away, the first verse, I just pushed the mic away and sang with no mic in front of me, you know, just to be like, you know, oh, I'm a rebel, you know. You know,
all right,
you know. And I thought that was really like my way of getting back at that guy. Whatever, it was kind of goofy, but at the same time I pushed the mic away and then grabbed it back and went back to my lip syncing, you know. We were pretty green, you know, we were pretty raw and green back then, especially doing that show. That was like the first time we were on TV, you know?
Yeah. And now that you mentioned that, I spliced together maybe the last minute of you guys doing Don't Tell Me You Love Me. And I posted that on the Night Ranger socials maybe 2 months ago. And I think it's over 300,000 views. So it's like, I should have known you guys were on American Bandstand, because I spent a good little chunk of time, you know, taking a segment out and yeah. putting it together and posting it for you guys. And, you know, but yeah, so, you know, you've got this first record out, Dawn Patrol's out, you guys, it's a success. You guys are out on tours with Kiss. You're out on tours with Sammy Hagar. You're American Bandstand, Solid Gold, Rock and Roll Tonight on NBC, which is one of those shows that didn't last long, but great archival footage. It's out there.
That was live too. You played live, so that was that was really cool.
Yes. Yeah, so there you go. If you're out there listening, go find Rock and Roll Tonight, Night Ranger 83. But you have all this, and this is like the musician side, right? The everything's going up, but how does that impact, you know, the fame part? How does that impact your relationships with the people that have been in your life?
Mm-hmm.
And then the new people trying to get into your life. You know, talk a little bit about, I mean, we all know the upside of fame. You know what I mean? You can get a table, you know, the good stuff, right? But talk about just some of the things that maybe people don't, you know, realize it comes with the fame.
Yeah, the tough part about it too, is in the beginning of your career, you know that it's, you know, you've got to keep the momentum going and you can't stop. You want to keep rolling and maybe into the next record. And, you know, after you do the tour, you have to go get ready for the next one. And where's the material coming from? Let's get going, you know. But yeah, I mean, back then, no cell phones, of course. So whenever, you know, if you wanted to be in touch with somebody, you had to, you know, you had to figure that out. Like how, you know, I'm in New York and they're back in California or whatever, you know. So it was tough on families. It was really tough on relationships, you know, because you'd just be cut off, you know, basically just cut off, you know, until you can make that phone call or drop a dime, as they used to say back in, you know, no more pay phones anymore, you know. Now we all have cell phones, but you know, unless you were in the hotel room or you were on the street and you make a call, that was the only time you could be in touch. So there was a lot of that dark space in between, you know. So it was tough on families, you know, and moms and dads, of course, were wondering what, you know, what's going on with you and stuff like that. So yeah, it was pretty difficult.
Did you ever, you know, was there ever, you know, because I sometimes read about it, you know, I've seen it to where, you know, you got you yourself and you've got your peers, other musicians, right? How, and you know, you've been equals for years, but all of a sudden you've made it and they're still here.
Mm-hmm.
How does that impact relationships? I mean, I'm sure there's some that they're happy for you and nothing changes, but I'm sure there's some where jealousy gets involved. Well, I'm just as talented as this guy. Do you get those types of relationships? And yeah,
you know, maybe some childhood friends. I have a friend that's still my close friend since the beginning. We played in bands first together when we were seven. A guy named John Pileggi, who's still playing amazing guitar. And
he just did some of your work on the song for your mother's tribute.
Exactly. He played all the instruments on that. And and then our other friend that was I kind of lost touch with, you know. And I don't think it was jealousy or anything like that. We just didn't keep in touch, you know, and I haven't heard from him for, you know, a long time. But I hear about him through John, you know, so I know he's still around and stuff like that. But, you know, as far as like the, you know, other musicians and peers like that, I mean, everybody was pretty much like, you know, man, I can't believe you guys are doing so great. And, you know, I hope we get to get that chance, you know, and sometimes they didn't, you know, and I always felt weird about fame back in the day. I always didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to rub it in, or I didn't want to boast, or I didn't want to. That was just me, you know. I wasn't good at talking about myself, you know. So I always kind of kept that to myself, you know. The whole fame thing I thought was fleeting, and or maybe could be, and didn't want to buy into it too much, you know, because it could go away tomorrow, you know.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the moment, moment by moment, you know.
Yeah. That's probably the best way to do it. And I guess the other thing with fame is you do find out you have a lot of cousins.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Yeah,
well,
you know, a lot of people would come out of the woodwork, and it was great. You know, it was
yeah.
great to have that extended family that you didn't know about.
Well, Kelly, thank you for jumping on here with us. Again, I'd love to have you keep coming on. We'll segment by segment, because the next it gets the Night Ranger story is constantly getting better. I mean, again, you're going to have these ups and downs, but we got the whole story arc of you guys are killing it,
And now
and
you're going to get a totally different story from Brad and a totally different story from Jack. I don't remember it like that. I remember it was
yeah. But you
going to
guys,
be really interesting.
then you got a record label going out of business that you guys are on.
We'll get to that one. Let's get to it.
But thank you for jumping on here with me, Kelly. And again, everyone, keep tuning in. We're going to hopefully keep getting these stories out here from Kelly. And again,
Go to the
Kelly,
next record after this.
I appreciate it, brother.
All right, my friend.
We'll get part two. I'll get all the notes ready, and man, we're gonna hit every fucking record. But Kelly, thank you for jumping on here with me, buddy.
Absolutely.
All right, everybody, there you go. Part two, Kelly Kagi, the Dawn Patrol era. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Do me a favor, go on the YouTube page or on the Facebook page and let me know, how much you enjoyed the interview, what new stuff you learned. Give me some feedback. If you haven't already, and you have found us maybe on YouTube, go and find us on Instagram, Threads, find us on Facebook. Facebook is obviously where most of the madness is at. Just type in Night Ranger Fans of Motion, click join. Over 10,000 members. What else? You can obviously watch the episodes on YouTube, but we are on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, all that great stuff, so you can listen to it on those podcatchers, and obviously www.fansofmotion.com. So listen, we got some great interviews coming up, some other things, some other type episodes coming up, so just stay tuned, and we will meet all your podcasts and Night Ranger needs. Until then, I will see you guys next week. Later.